Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now, as I say, time for the Friday gathering. This week I'm joined by Fianna Fáil TD for Kildare North and Minister of State at the Department of Transport and the Department of Environment, Climate and Communications, James Lawless. Independent TD for Wexford, Verona Murphy. Deputy Political Editor with the Irish Examiner, Elaine Loughlin. And media consultant and founder of Effective Aid Ukraine, Tom McEnany. Good morning to you all. Can we start with Michael O'Leary trying to reignite this debate about the cap on passenger numbers coming through Dublin Airport? James Lawless, as both Minister for State at the Transport and Environment, I mean, you're going to know what the arguments around tourist numbers are, you're going to know what the argument around climate science is. Could we increase the capacity of Dublin Airport to 60 million passengers, as Michael O'Leary has argued this morning, and not reap a whirlwind?
Well, we can increase capacity on the island overall, including at Dublin Airport, and I think we should. But before we talk about Dublin, let's not forget that Shannon and Cork have no cap, have no limitations whatsoever. I visited both. I'm actually the minister responsible for aviation. I visited both airports only the last couple of weeks. They're crying out for more passengers, all singing, all dancing. Shannon has US pre-clearance. Cork has ambition to go to 5 million passengers. Cork is actually promising through the DEA a special deal for airlines to fly more flights out of it. So if Michael Leary is looking for extra flights, go to Cork, go to Shannon, on top of what he's doing at Dublin Airport. And I think the people of those regions would welcome that. And I know the airlines, the airports certainly would.
A good argument well made for balanced regional development, absolutely. But that's not what Michael O'Leary is interested in. He wants flights in Dublin.
And he has flights in Dublin, 32 million of them in the current year alone. So, look, I think we would all agree that out of a personal view that the airport should continue to grow. I think the aviation objective is that it is a strategic hub for the island and indeed for further afield. But we can't break the law. We can't get involved in saying, well, we're going to... So the situation here, it's a legacy situation. It's a bit of a Hobson's choice for me as a new minister and indeed for Minister Ryan. Do we allow the situation where Dublin Airport becomes limited, which is not ideal at all, and the knock-on from that? Or do we get involved and start riding roughshod over the planning system? The real problem here, Dublin Airport has continued to grow, which is a good thing. It's added runways, it's added terminals, it's added capacity, it's added extra features, extra dimensions over the last number of years. And with all of those, as they've gone through the planning, there's been certain conditions imposed. So the runway had an overnight, I think it's 700 flights per night because of local noise fears. The terminal had a condition because of surface access. So the road, metro, bus transport to the airport had to grow with it. So these are all reasonable things to do. The problem is that now we're at the point where they're beginning to be hit and actually exceeded those conditions. Should the DEA have applied sooner than the very last minute for an expansion of the cap? Of course they should. Why weren't they in there 5 years ago applying to lift it?
Do you think, Verona Murphy, that there might be an absence of joined up thinking here? That we spent $320 million on a second runway while there was a cap of 32 million passengers in place, but the point of the second runway was that you were going to be able to fly 60 million people in and out of Dublin.
Yeah, I think that is just common sense and joined up thinking. I'm not sure who's right in the argument with regards to what we can or can't do, but I do know, and James will know this, we certainly can bring guidelines through the planning system now. And if a new application was to be made, those guidelines would then fit the new situation we find ourselves in. And I think that's how you, if it's disingenuous for government to say that we can't do anything and then, you know, expect that flight prices will stay the same. This is important, Phil, because I think what Michael O'Leary said this morning is that at Christmas, people can expect to pay something in the region of €500 one way, flying from the UK, possibly into Dublin. Just to finish the point, I have no difficulty. The minister can make changes. He can accommodate in the same way that it's disingenuous to tell people, we're doing it for all the right reasons and we're not increasing it, but then ticket prices
and that
are
was,
not going
wasn't,
to go up. So be truthful.
Elaine, that was a really rather remarkable assertion, wasn't it? Because one would wonder, what's the basis for increasing them to 500 euros?
If
his underlying costs are not changing.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think that was one of it has to be said, has been a Punch and Judy show for many months now between Minister Ryan and the head of Ryanair. And we've seen back and forth, we've seen meetings, we've seen press releases issued, even discussions over the airwaves on this. And it doesn't seem like it's a debate or a row that's going to end anytime soon. But I was taken by the fact that Michael O'Leary did go on and say, if this does continue at Christmas time one way, as Verona has said, it'll be €500 for your flight to London and €500 back. So for a family of five, is it feasible to even come home to see Granny and Granddad at Christmas time? I'm not sure.
But what is the justification for that?
Well, that's the question you have to say. Well,
to be fair, Verona,
I think if you look at it, if the underlying cost of flying your family of five from London to Dublin doesn't increase, what is the reason, apart from supply and demand, that Michael O'Leary is going to double or triple the airline costs? And I think customers do have a right to question that. You know, we have had discussions probably on this panel before around if Taylor Swift is in town or if there's a big concert in Dublin and suddenly the price of a hotel skyrockets and people say that's price gouging.
Tom McEnany, was it just Michael O'Leary hyperbole or was it a threat?
I think it was a warning. I don't think it was either a threat or hyperbole. Ryanair operates in a very competitive market. It can't have ticket prices that are going to be out of line with all of its competitors. Otherwise, nobody's going to fly Ryanair. I think there's nothing wrong with, by the way, Ryanair making a profit. Sometimes we discount what Michael O'Leary says just because we know that he's thinking in terms of Ryanair's profits. But in this case, I think he's dead right. We have an artificial limit.
Sorry, he's dead right.
Absolutely correct to warn that having an artificial cap of 32 million passengers per year at Dublin Airport.
Okay, but in what world does that lead to a tenfold increase in ticket prices?
Ticket prices, like hotel rooms, are very sensitive to supply and demand. So that if we have a restriction at Christmas, if the Irish Aviation Authority puts in restrictions at Christmas because it wants to allow more flights at other times of the year, well, then that means there are going to be fewer people flying, there are going to be fewer seats available, and those seats are going to be more expensive. It's the people who won't be able to fly are poorer people. Rich people will still be able to.
James Lawless, does it follow that just because demand has increased, that price has to increase as well? Surely that's a choice of the company.
I would think so. And of course, I understand supply and demand. And the scarcer resource is, the more that the producer may get away with charging for it on an open market. Just because you can doesn't mean that you should. So if, as Elaine has rightly said, if it costs X amount for a Ryanair flight into Dublin and out of Dublin today, it's going to cost broadly the same fuel price, etc. apart in 6 months' time and 12 months' time. The fact that there may not be able to be further flights coming in later that day or the next day shouldn't affect the price of the flight that's coming in. So if Mick O'Leary if Mick O'Leary wants to leverage a situation where there is pressure on the airport coming towards the end of the year to jack up his prices tenfold, that's a decision that his company can make. Okay. Maybe they'll get away with it in the short term, but I don't see how the situation is putting up prices. He is actually engineering the situation and taking advantage to jack up prices if that's what's happening.
That's logical. Verona?
Oh, it's not really logical. It's the premise of any business is supply and demand. I mean, it's housing. It's any business of whatsoever. You limit supply, you increase demand, it drives up the price. When government can't build houses and we don't have enough houses, it drives up rents and the price of houses. So I agree with the premise. Can they do something about it? Yes. Do the government choose not to? Yes. But what they can't say is that they have then not played a part in driving up the price of those
tickets.
There
is a climate context in which all of this sits. Elaine, how fair is it to keep on asking more of those in the transport sector? I knew I'd get your ears to be pricked up there, Verona. More of farmers when we're having a debate about how much we should let the aviation industry increase its emissions and increase its business.
Mm-hmm. And I think Michael O'Leary this morning pointed out that aviation only accounts for 2%.
That's not what the science says, but that's a debate for another day.
Yes. And I suppose you can maybe look at it, and Verona might agree with me on this, perhaps we need to be looking more at ferry travel and increasing capacity at the likes of Rosslare or Dublin Port. Again, do we look to Cork? People may not want to fly into Cork. You have to say you could put on multiple flights, and flights have been put on in the likes of Cork and Shannon and then have been withdrawn because of a lack of demand. Okay. So some of these solutions in theory sound very good, but people want to fly into Dublin, and that's just the reality.
The bottom line is, though, we are an island nation.
Okay.
Yeah. We are an island nation.
You have to think in terms of what tourists want instead of what we want to give tourists. And if tourists want to come into Dublin, it's not realistic to say you should be going into Cork instead. They'll just choose to go to Paris or somewhere else.
Correct.
And also the government seems to be suggesting that when it comes to aviation, as opposed to every other part of the market in Ireland, with the exception of the rental market, that we should have some level of price control. That's not the way business in Ireland works. It simply isn't. And price controls, by the way, don't work. And it's strange that that James would be suggesting that when it comes to aviation, as opposed to every other sector of the economy, that price, there should be some level of price control, as opposed to free market, the way it works at the moment.
But as a government,
Verona, I'll let you back in.
We're the only country that doesn't have a train connection to mainland Europe. You can jump on a train in London.
We're the only island of mainland Europe. Christ almighty, Verona, that's an obvious one. Okay, can I respond to Tom's point? First of all, I don't understand. Why does Verona think we don't have a train connection to mainland Europe? Because we're the only island of mainland Europe. Great Britain has the Channel Tunnel that was built in the 80s. We're the only island off the west coast.
That's
Germany,
point.
France,
my
Belgium.
My point is, we have to consider
aviation
differently.
We're the only island, Verona. So just to Tom's point, I'm not suggesting for a minute that we do price control. What I'm saying is, I'm asking for a justification as to why would it be that a flight that costs at the moment, the operational this cost is 50 quid a head, is now going to be 500 quid a head.
I know
you're going back.
So if we're going to ask Ryanair numbers to justify its prices, why not bread makers? Why not car makers? Why not every other section of the economy? Ryanair operates.
We often put it up to people and say, why don't we? But price control is very different. Price control would be the government getting involved, which I don't intend to do for a second.
It's a deflection from the issue. The issue is your cap and numbers.
Can I talk without being interrupted, please?
Go on.
Thank you. So price control would be getting involved in setting prices and being a price maker and fixer. That's not the business at all. But I'm merely asking a question which arises to me as a natural conclusion of what was said this morning. Why is it that the price would increase tenfold? Because there is an opportunity to jack the prices up to a certain level. So I think we're seeing... Michael O'Leary is well known for being a bluff and bluster
and
merchant.
You're saying you've played no actor part in that by capping numbers.
And I am saying to Michael O'Leary this morning on the radio, I'm very happy to meet with him tomorrow, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, whenever. I've been meeting all the stakeholders. I was in Rosslare in Verona's constituency yesterday, meeting the port, fantastic opportunities there.
Took a long time to realise that one too.
Last point on this, please, Elaine.
So my door's open.
It just came to me now. We say, the point has been made here on the panel, that you can't ask people, let's say, to go to Cork. You have to give them what they want. But it's slightly ironic because Ryanair has built their business on bringing people to not the centre of Rome, to not the centre of Paris, but to airports.
Okay,
so it's very good.
Welcome to Cork, Dublin. I'm going to move the conversation on, and I want you to sort out something for me here, Elaine, please. The suggestion was made in the context of conversation around housing and cost of living by a government minister this week let me phrase it that way, that there might be a tax credit for the under 25s considered. Is this a runner or is this a kite?
This is silly season. And I think...
No such thing.
Ever since Willie O'Dea and his, what was it, €2 on the pension, we've had all sorts of suggestions put out in July and August around budget and what various parties might want. Now, it may come to pass. I think everything is on the table, especially ahead of a general election. We might see a few little surprises, a few little sweets in Budget 2025.
But that was the first time that you have heard of this particular idea of a tax credit to the under 25s.
I think in those type of words and the way it was iterated, okay, I think that is something new. Whether it would work, I don't know, because you have to say if you are providing a tax credit to those in that age cohort, are you then blocking maybe people in their 30s from saving a deposit who really need a house, because at that point maybe they've 3 kids and are in a one-bed apartment. So are you helping one cohort and then further pushing out another cohort from the housing?
Some say silly season, others say an opportunity for considering new ideas. Tom, you had a suggestion in this area about using the tax code to incentivise bringing builders back.
And my view is that if you're going to use tax credits, you should use them strategically. And when it comes to housing, which is the biggest crisis we have in Ireland, the biggest problem we have in Ireland, one of the key issues, not the only issue, but I would say probably one of the critical issues, is the number of builders we have in Ireland. So during the boom, we had about 240,000 builders. Now we have 160,000. Huge reduction. The better part of 100,000 people reskilled and went into hospitality or went off to Australia or went to Canada. And we need to bring them back. And it doesn't matter what you do about planning. It doesn't matter what broad tax incentives you give to developers. If there aren't enough builders to actually build the houses, then you can't.
So what kind of a tax credit are you proposing?
So I'm looking at, or I'm suggested to, in a paper to government last year and in a column to this, with the Sunday Independent last year, I suggested a €10,000 tax credit. So a credit on 10,000 of which would actually
for,
only
for all builders or for the ones coming back?
Only for new builders.
Oh, two
only
tier for people building
two market. Tier, absolutely. Absolutely. No argument.
You're happy to promote that inequality, are you?
Yeah, I'm happy because it means there'll be more houses and more houses benefits everybody. And cheaper houses benefits everybody. I'm not talking about benefiting building companies. This is individual people on an average wage of 37,000 a year. And it's because it's a critical need of Ireland right now.
And
we
would
need
this be a tax credit in perpetuity or just for a year?
For a number of years, and then we could review it after a couple of years. Obviously, when we have enough houses, we don't need the tax credit anymore.
Okay. James Lawless, is this a kite that you can blow a little bit of wind into the sails of?
It's not my kite. I think you're right in the sense that this is a time of year for knocking about ideas. We're in the pre-budget environment. I'm reminded of another Fine Gael minister who I think was talking about grants for people to go home.
Running very hard and fast in the other direction away from that suggestion.
Well, I remember Minister Radcliffe when he was at the time was talking about giving grants for people to leave the country. Now we have another Fine Gael minister talking about giving them grants to stay in the country. But look, one of the things I thought about in this when this suggestion was made was about, there's an often suggested idea that we train people to leave. So our medics, in particular doctors, nurses, healthcare workers, possibly engineers as well. And we see a lot of young talent being trained up in the Irish state and then going abroad. So I had a look at that and there was a study from last year by, I think it was the Medical Council. And what I found was quite interesting, first of all, it said the majority of Irish trained doctors, nurses, etc., actually don't leave the country. And those that do typically come back maybe within 10 years. I have a sister myself who actually trained, then worked as a GP in Australia and has come back to live in Ireland in the last 12 months. So I know that cycle is real. And actually, often they gain experience and skills by that international exposure, which they then bring back to the country. So, because I was thinking along the lines of maybe we could tweak that suggestion to say that people who were trained up in particular areas would stay around for a while after as a sort of condition. But when I looked at the stats, actually, that's not really what's happening. They're coming back anyway. So,
Verona, does it sound like a good idea or do you end up with a tax system that's incoherent?
Well, it's not that I disagree with Tom, but as a politician, I don't have anybody lobbying me for a shortage of building labour. And I do think that there are many things wrong with the housing market and we probably have shortage in certain areas. But I don't think that that's
well,
the
you
big
must
issue.
Have everything in your house completely built then and you don't need to try and get any kind of a tradesman because nobody in the country, nobody else in the country can.
But they're not on the critical skills list. We have a shortage of drivers, truck drivers, bus drivers. They're on the critical skills list. We don't necessarily, we're not looking for electricians, block layers. The issue I would say is that we have quite a number of people here, whether they are in the international protection system or whether they are just here for whatever, that we should be training and upskilling and bringing into people who are already here, whether they be homeless or whatever, that they can upskill. I mean, I have a brother in Australia. He's there 10 years. He was a builder. He's not looking to come back to Ireland. He likes the climate over there. He's building over there. He's not interested in coming back here.
And I'm not tax credit for 10 grand for a couple of years
not.
Wouldn't be enough to bring him back.
Absolutely not. For a start, he wouldn't be able to get car insurance. He wouldn't be able to find a home of his own. You'd have all those issues.
The first of all, there's a plethora of reports, including from the central bank, saying that the lack of construction workers in Ireland is a key issue. So that's a proven point. When it comes to doctors and nurses, I think James is absolutely right, and it would be great to be able to attract more doctors, more nurses, more healthcare workers generally to Ireland. But the key issue is housing. The key issue for all of them is housing. So I would suggest that it would make sense to prioritise bringing back people who can bring houses, and helping the mammy factor, helping the mammies of Ireland persuade their sons and daughters to come back to Ireland with something that is a little bit bold and a little bit eye-catching and say, listen, now there's a good reason for you to be coming back because you could be making more money.
And the only issue with it is, and everybody wants to see a scale up in the delivery of housing, we need more housing. everybody, I think, on this panel agrees. Everybody, I'd imagine, listening in agrees with that. But if you have a housing crisis, a shortage of housing, and then you want to bring in tens of thousands more people to build more homes, where are they going to live? I don't know how you square that circle, and it's a...
I think just to be fair to the suggestion, even though, look, it is a discussion point, it's only that, but he wasn't necessarily talking about bringing more people in. He was talking about keeping the ones that we have. Stopping people from leaving, I think, is the thrust of it.
Well, no. I'm talking about getting people who move to working in restaurants in Ireland,
sure,
and getting them to move back into construction. But also, and there's a lot of those. There's tens of thousands of those.
Yeah. And we do need
and they
skills.
Wouldn't need new houses. Okay.
Yeah.
But I'm also talking about bringing people back. Some of those would move back in with their families. Mm. But the fact is, we do bring in workers all the time. We bring in
healthcare
workers.
You can't expect someone who's living in Australia to move back in with their mother and father and maybe have three kids after living possibly with a swimming pool in Perth. Like, that's not going to entice anybody back.
I think loads of people are coming. I think loads of people do come back. My own brother is a builder, came back from Australia. Yeah. Loads of people want to come back and are looking for reasons to come back. And if we make it just that little bit more attractive and a little bit easier for families to try and persuade
the
them to come
the
back, I think that would be a useful thing. And the thing is, if it doesn't work, it doesn't cost anything.
I agree, but I think the premise
is
our housing system is broken. The process in which we build houses is completely broken. And if it's not viable to build houses, we certainly
don't
need
cohorts. Let me move
cohorts.
The conversation on, if we can, please. E-scooters and the scheme that's now being run in Wexford. How comfortable are you that Wexford is, and Wexford's narrow roads and even narrower footpaths sometimes are well suited to a project like this?
Well, how comfortable I am. I live in rural Ireland, and having e-scooters, or rural Wexford, I should say, e-scooters on our roads are pure hazard. And I think everybody knows that there's no proper safety guidelines or mandatory safety measures, such as wearing a helmet, high-vis jacket. People are very concerned. That's not to say. The idea is, I'm sure, that it's in the towns as opposed to the countryside. James, I might be wrong in that, but I believe the pilot program is for towns and to create this enhance the 15-minute city idea. People, there are reservations. We do need sustainable and more sustainable transport, but a limitation on the speed of 20 kilometres to someone who's every bone in their body exposed to the elements if something happens, whether they fall off, whether they're knocked off. We've had some very serious incidents resulting in deaths. So there are a number of concerns that have not been catered for.
James Lawless, you launched this scheme yesterday, even though several cities around the world have decided, no, we're going to go in the other direction and get rid of them.
Yeah, so first of all, just in terms of the point, the suggestion that there isn't guidelines. So there are not only guidelines, there are laws, regulations and guidance notes. So the Road Traffic Act was introduced in April, which deals with e-scooters. Regulations were introduced in May, and I issued a guidance note to all local authorities last month in terms of how they might adopt these schemes. And I suppose we benefited in a way from being a late adopter, because other cities have piloted them, have tried them. You know, probably all of us around the panel and many listeners who have been in places like Brussels, Paris, Amsterdam in recent years, and have seen e-scooters being actually really popular. One of the reasons some cities are stepping back is the way that they did it. So, for example, the Wexford scheme, which I launched yesterday, has dedicated docking bays. So you get the bike out, it's on your e-card, it's on your account. If you take, you know, forever with it, that's on your own cost. But when you bring it back to a designated docking bay. It's actually a virtual bay, it's sort of e-tagged.
Okay.
But Paris, the reason they banned them in Paris is people are throwing them on the side of the street. People are throwing them on the curb, throwing them on a set of steps.
But to address Verona's road safety concerns, there's no, unlike motorbikes, unlike cars, there's no training here. There might be regulations, but there's no training. The only qualification you need is to have a credit card.
Yeah, so... well, I think probably all of us around the table remember our first time hopping on a bike. These are a modern form of bicycle. They don't travel any faster than a bike. The only difference is they have a little battery engine at the back of them. And they're an exciting, affordable, environmentally friendly way for young and not so young people to get around our urban centres. They may not be suitable. I think they're probably not suitable for wide-scale use on rural roads, for example. But they're an ideal solution for somewhere like Wexford Town. Really good progressive council there. Really good work done on by the active travel team down there. And I have to say, to Bolt, the private company involved as well,
They've invested a lot in this, not just in terms of money, but in terms of technology, in terms of time, given this thought. So, for example, if the e-scooter is operating and it starts to wobble or it mounts a curb or it detects that the user is not in control, it cuts out. You know, that's all
what
built
about
in.
Road
so
safety?
We've learned from, I suppose, the mistakes of other cities. So we've looked at what other cities have done. We've looked at the international experience, and that's been brought to bear. And this is a pilot. This is a 6-month pilot. The new regulations which are brought in are a 12-month pilot. And let's look at this again in 6 months. Let's look at it again 12 months. But we cannot ignore what's happening. We kind of turn our eyes and say, let's pretend they don't exist, because people
James,
are using them already.
You can't ignore 4 deaths in recent month of e-scooters. You can't ignore that. I'm not saying that we shouldn't
so
have them.
So unfortunately, you're also going to have fatalities on bicycles. You're going to have fatalities in cars. We're always trying to drive those down.
But in a car, you're not exposed to the elements
on a bicycle,
in the same
are.
Way. Well,
on
you can't do the same speed of pedal
so,
power that these scooters
20 kilometres per hour.
Can I get another perspective?
The speed
on
limit,
this.
Age
Tom.
Limit, engine limits.
Tom, you started life as an engineer, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Way back in the day, I think it's a great idea. I think it's a great idea as a pilot. And the best way of learning is to actually do it. You know, in terms of how are people going to behave? What are the implications? How is it going to work for Wexford? Let's try it and let's see it. And I think we should be doing more of this. When it comes to scooters, particularly because this is these are rental scooters, so they're limited in terms of speed. I would have a greater concern about non-rental scooters, privately owned scooters. And I'd like to see us do what other countries do, which is you have Gardaí, specially trained Gardaí with machines that can come out, and they can just stop the scooters, put them onto the devices, check what their maximum speed is, and if their maximum speed is higher than what it should be, take them away from them. I think with rental scooters where they're already limited, I think that's okay. Mm-hmm. You can make an argument that there isn't the infrastructure and there are road safety dangers, but exactly the same arguments can be made with bicycles. And if we don't have the infrastructure, if we say we can't have more bicycles on the road because there isn't enough until we have the right infrastructure, we'd never have anybody cycling.
But can you do all of this without re-engineering the roads to make way for
ideally, no. Ideally, you'd have cycle paths, and ideally, you'd have separate cycle paths and separate scooter paths. But we're just not going to go. We're not. It's just not practical.
Elaine?
Yeah, I think that's what it comes down to. It is the infrastructure. And if you look here in Dublin City, it's slightly different. But the Dublin Bikes has been rolled out for many years and has been highly successful. Yeah. But there are streets that I would happily go down on a Dublin bike and streets that I would actively avoid because I know I'm taking my life in my hands. I might be in between a double-decker bus and a truck, a delivery truck. So I think you have to have those lanes that people know that they're safe and they're secure on to use these e-scooters.
Okay, let me move the bikes. I've used those for years and really loved using them, but I remember when they came out first, there's all these predictions that all end up in the Liffey, that all end up in someone's garage. None of that happened. All the doomsday predictions didn't come to pass. They're a great scheme. I've used the Dublin bikes for years, and e-scooters are the next generation of that.
James, presuming that you are re-elected after the next election, are you looking forward to perhaps sitting beside Gráinne Seoghaire on the Fianna Fáil benches?
I wish Gráinne all the best. I understand that she has put forward her interest in running for the party. We're in the business of attracting new talent all the time. There's an open invitation to any interested parties that might meet our values to come on board.
Okay. I think Gráinne would be very good fit. With you, though, as somebody who went through all the hard yards of getting elected onto a council, what is more than 10 years ago now, and you know, serving your time, learning your craft, doing your apprenticeship, seeing celebrity candidates being parachuted in like that.
Yeah, well, I'm sure when I ran first, there were people, in fact, I know for a fact, there were people looking over my shoulder that were already ahead of me saying, who does he think he is? You know, that's the nature of politics. You know, a newcomer comes along and maybe everyone else looks behind them. But no, I absolutely welcome if Gráinne, and I suppose ultimately, as Eamon Aquive rightly said, it's up to the membership in Galway. But I think she'd be a fine candidate. I know there's others out there as well, Ollie Crowe, John Connolly, maybe Peter Kane. There's another number of people.
Verona, what do you think it says about the main parties that they seem to be increasingly turned to celebrities or high-profile candidates?
Well, it is a party issue. As an independent, you can just decide to run. You don't have to go through, as you say,
but what do you think that it says about those parties?
Well, look, I mean, one celebrity candidate does not mean that they have an issue that way. I think the issue is that people don't want to abide by the party whip system. They can't represent people. Parties are about parties. They're not about people. As an independent, I am utmost about people. I don't have to consider the party's thinking. I don't have to consider whether or which I'm going to be harangued if I say something that represents a constituent. It's just parties are about parties. And I think Gráinne Seoghaire, we need more women. And primarily I came through the system James is talking about, and ask me, is it not what's the word? It's not female friendly, right, and it's certainly not new member friendly.
Elaine, last 30 seconds.
Yeah, and look at it, celebrity candidates have always been, if you can go back technically, Jack Lynch, you could say, was a celebrity candidate. If you go back that far, it's something that works sometimes, and we've had celebrity candidates, so-called celebrity candidates, that haven't made it through. But I think that name recognition does help, and we did see it in the most recent European.
Do you think we're seeing
elections
a disproportionate amount of it now, though, is my question.
Well, we have Grainne Shoiga, who's may or may not get through the party selection convention.
Nina Carberry.
Nina Carberry at European election. You could claim Cynthia Nwoerku as well. Mm-hmm. Certainly in the Europeans, I think they're a different dynamic. Okay. And
but
name
I do think if
Grainne
doesn't get selected, she's welcome to give me a call. I'd advise her running independently.
Verona Murphy, Elaine Loughlin, Tom McEnany, James Lawless, thank you all very much.